Today is Tuesday, the 19th of September. We're in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Myron Megan for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution. Yeah. Okay. The sesquicentennial of Michigan State is coming up in 2005, and this project is part of that. Dr. Megan, you can see that we're tape recording this today. Do you give us permission to tape?
Yes, I do.
I'd like to start first with a little bit about your general educational and professional background. Where were you born, and where did you go to school?
I was born March 1st, 1926 in Brooklyn, New York. Attended public schools in New York, including Erasmus Hall High School. Graduated in 1941 from high school. Entered New York University, the Uptown campus when they had one. Spent 2 years there until I was drafted into the Navy, and spent 2 years in the Navy during World War II in the Pacific Theater. Went back to NYU, and then was 12 credits short of my bachelor's degree when I was accepted at what was then the Still College of Osteopathic Medicine in Des Moines, Iowa. Graduated from there, entered there in 1947, graduated in 1951, did an internship and residency in pediatrics there. Went down, practiced in Dallas, Texas for 2 years, came back to Des Moines, was chairman of the Department of Pediatrics there until 1963 when we came to Michigan. Private practice of pediatrics for a number of years in Wyandotte, Michigan. Was chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Riverside Hospital in Trenton, Detroit Osteopathic Hospital in Detroit. Then went to Botsford Ziegler Hospitals as medical director and director of medical education. Spent 5 years there. Became part-time dean of the Michigan College of Osteopathic Medicine. We entered our first class as a private school in 1969. In 1970, we became part of Michigan State University, and I was appointed the first dean. In the process, I've served on numerous government committees. I have about 40 publications, primarily in pediatrics and education. I've served on various committees for the profession, the American Osteopathic Association. I've been president of the Michigan College of Medical School Deans when there was a formal organization. I'm the only osteopathic physician who's a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, and only one of two faculty on the campus who are members of the Institute of Medicine. I stepped down from the deanship 10 years ago and am currently professor of pediatrics, although I would be dangerous if I had to practice medicine.
Thumbnail.
Married with three children. Three boys. One of whom is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Michigan State. One of whom is an emergency medicine physician in Soldotna, Alaska. And one of whom is an associate professor of social work at the University of Alaska in Anchorage.
We've asked all of our interviewees who had served in World War II, what did you serve? What aspect was your service in the Navy?
I was a fire controlman, which meant that I operated radar and range finders. I was the pointer on a Mark 37 gun director aboard the light cruiser Amsterdam, which we put into commission in Newport News, Virginia, and then joined the Pacific Fleet. We joined just after Okinawa. We were conducting carrier operations 65 miles off the Japanese coast. When the war ended, we were part of the fleet that was present both in Tokyo Bay and out at the surrender. I then transferred to the heavy cruiser St. Paul, which was detached 2 weeks later from the 3rd Fleet to carry the flag for the commander of the Yangtze Patrol, and we anchored in the Wangpo River off the Bund in Shanghai. Spent a couple of months there, then we were detached to San Pedro, California, where we carried the flag for the Commander Battleship Cruisers Pacific Fleet, and then I got out.
So nothing in your naval
experience. It was a great deal of pleasure.
Well, nothing in your naval experience stimulated your interest in medicine?
Or no. I had wanted to be a physician since I was 6 years old when I had my appendix out.
Oh, that did
it. That stimulated it, yeah.
That did it.
Yeah. 1932.
Mm-hmm. Who was the doctor that did that surgery? You remember?
Yeah. Sure. The doctor's name was Sarnoff. Mm-hmm. He was related to David Sarnoff of CBS. Mm-hmm. And his daughter is Dorothy Sarnoff, who was a voice teacher. So,
did you have a relationship with him later on?
No.
Your medical education, did you have a specialty interest in
pediatrics? Yeah.
I know, but did you have that early, or was there something?
No. That came always, later. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The how and why did you come to Michigan State?
Well, I enjoyed my job at Ziegler Botsford Hospital. I really didn't want to come to Michigan State. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of pushes to and fro. I was the dean of the private college for the short time that we were in existence. And had a kid in high school, and we were enjoying West Bloomfield, Michigan, where we lived. And I was induced as an obligation, basically, to take it, and said, well, I'd take it for 3 months. And 30 years later, I'm still here. So.
Who asked you to be
the profession, mm-hmm. basically, yeah.
I see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were you involved at all in the development of the school here?
Yes.
prior to your coming?
Yeah.
How was it? Did they have the medical school at that time before the osteopathic
yes.
school?
Yeah.
They had it at the same
They were, I think, 4 years ahead of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were a 2-year school to begin with.
Mm-hmm. How, which president did you have the most dealings with in those early years?
Well, we started out under Walter Adams. Mm-hmm. And then Walter, of course, served for 1 year, and then Clifton Wharton came aboard. Mm-hmm. And after Clifton, we had Ed Hardin, who had been a consultant to us all along in the development of the college, mm-hmm. when we were trying to get it started as both a private and a public institution. And then, of course, after Cliff, Cecil Mackey. And after Cecil, DiBiagio, and then Gordon Geyer, mm-hmm. and currently Peter McPherson. I've served under provost, starting with John Cantlin, all the way now through Luana Simon.
Mm-hmm. Were there, of those that you've mentioned, were there any that were either more supportive of the school, or did you find them uniformly supportive, or?
I think the thing you've got to understand is that the faculty didn't vote to take us in. Mm-hmm. This was the first unanimous vote by the Board of Trustees at that time. Mm-hmm. In 1970, a board that was split between Republicans and Democrats. I would say that none were more or less supportive. We had our pushes and pulls with a number of them. I have a genetic predisposition not to be enamored of provosts. although I like some of them, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry him. They were all decent people. We just had certainly policy differences of opinion.
Mm-hmm. The in the early development, in the early years, how did the mission of osteopathic medicine fit with the land grant mission of the university?
Yeah,
where did you see the fit?
Well, it fit very well. Mm-hmm. The reason we got the college, without question, well, why the legislature supported it. There's a picture over there of the signing of the bill. Why the legislature supported it was the fact that the osteopathic physicians in the state of Michigan were practicing at a community level. They were in the trenches. A good share of them were practicing in relatively small towns. But in addition, the majority of them were primary care. We didn't have a great deal of specialization. And of course, that fit in perfectly with Michigan State University's land grant philosophy of bringing whatever knowledge was developed to the people and to bring it to the people for the benefit of the people. So obviously the two fit in very, very well.
Within the field of medicine, what would you say that there were some of the earlier successes based on the faculty that you gathered? What were some of the areas of focus?
Oh, I think...
Or strengths, let's say.
I think one of the strengths we had... The thing that must be remembered is that we had a problem. In order to understand the dynamics, you have to understand the dynamics, the medical environment, and what had occurred. It had only been back in the 60s that the American Medical Association, as an actual policy, removed from the osteopathic physician the designation quack, or cultist.
Mm-hmm.
It had been their stated policy previous to that in effect an MD physician could not consult with a DO physician. Now, I'm not saying that everyone adhered to that. I think the relationship in Michigan was mixed. There are areas where the cooperation was excellent, there are areas where it wasn't. In addition, at that time, the osteopathic profession consisted of only 5 schools, private, poorly funded, tuition-driven, and so that we, in 1970, became the first state-supported, although Ed Hardin preferred the term state-assisted, because it was his contention, and he was quite correct, that no state institution is ever state-supported, mm-hmm. Since a good share of their money comes from non-state funding, and they couldn't live on the state funding. So we were the first state-assisted. Now remember, we then became the 6th College of Osteopathic Medicine. We were the first new college in 53 years. And as of now, there are 19 colleges of osteopathic medicine, of which more than half are state-supported. So that we did, I think, a couple of things. Number one, placing a College of Osteopathic Medicine at an AAU university such as Michigan State University immediately catapulted the profession into the mainstream of American education. It gave me, as dean, visibility in areas where we had never had visibility before, not because it was me, but because I was dean of a college at Michigan State University. It allowed us then to show the rest of the educational establishment that we really didn't have horns, and that a duck didn't follow us around going quack, quack, when we walk. And let me indicate that there was mixed feelings on the part of the profession. There are many in the profession who felt that this was the death knell of the profession, because here we were being catapulted onto a major university with an MD school right next door, or as a partner, and that we would be swallowed up. That's one segment of the profession. Another segment of the profession didn't recognize that once the college became a public institution, they in effect had lost control of it. And it probably took 2 years before the profession recognized that while I was the dean, the rest of them were not associate deans. So to begin with, I had 3,000 associate deans, each of whom maintained that he or she was the father or mother of the college. So that, in effect, was the situation we found ourselves in. So we had to attempt to prove to university faculty and others that they had no monopoly on quality or knowledge, that we were just as interested in academic quality as anyone else was, and we were just as interested in doing the things within a major university that any college is supposed to do. Public service, teaching, research, etc. In that vein, John Cantlin, and we had started on the campus on Pontiac, assigned Bob Schutz as our advisor. He was in the provost's office at that, or he was in the Institute of Biology and Medicine at that time. And also, immediately, faculty from the university began teaching at Pontiac for the class that was still there, that had started there, so that Phil Gerhardt, who was chairman of microbiology, would send people down and so on. Dozier Thornton was appointed to our admissions committee to assist us, and also to make sure that the that quality was maintained. So that in effect there was an attempt by the provost to assist us and get us knowledgeable vis-a-vis the university. I had not been in an institution of higher learning except for a couple of education courses since I got out of my medical school experience, and the osteopathic colleges in those days were freestanding institutions. Consequently, I was an inexperienced dean and was thrown into the Council of Deans meetings immediately. And I assume if I came back there 30 years or 10 years later, they'd still be discussing the same things that were then.
And hard to get people off the dime.
And had probably made as many decisions, which means almost none, but that's for sure.
The bureaucracy moves slowly, the bigger the institution.
Yeah.
How would you describe the campus when you first came in terms of the whole, or the with the
atmosphere?
Yes.
Well, there are a number of people in the in the university, one or two in chemistry, one or two in economics, who were vocal critics. But of course, many of them had been angry since the days John Hanna started the MD institution without asking. Mm-hmm. And they felt they should have been asked, consulted, and should have had a part in the decision. In addition, everyone was convinced, not everyone, but a good share of people were convinced that once again we were going to take money from them. And yet, interestingly enough, we came up here with funding from the state, so that while the university had given us a $30,000 check to help us meet our payroll while we were in the transition. We had a funding line from the state, and so we had a line item appropriation, and the university really, we weren't taking money out of anyone's pocket. The assumption, of course, by faculty is that if one or both of the medical schools would disappear, that money would be available for use by the remainder of the faculty. A questionable opinion, but whatever. Then, of course, the question was, why do you need two medical schools, et cetera, et cetera. Again, the thing that has to be remembered is that from the standpoint of public policy, it was public policy in this country at that time that there was a shortage of physicians, particularly at the community level, and that we needed more primary care physicians. Michigan was a net exporter of physicians, and the legislature used to scream that the graduates of Wayne and University of Michigan were supplying the states of Florida and California with physicians. So, and of course, the three medical schools, CHM, U of M, and Wayne, maintained that it would have been much cheaper to expand the size of their classes than for us. But it was a political battle, which we won. Mm-hmm. And, period.
Who was the dean here on campus of the School of Human Medicine?
Andy Hunt.
Andy Hunt, okay. How would you describe your relationship with him?
Good. Mm-hmm. Andy was a gentleman, highly intelligent gentleman, who probably received much less credit for the development of community-based MD schools than he should have.
Mm-hmm. So both the College of Human Medicine and the Osteopathic School here worked to increase the family practice, and so you're unified in that mission.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. The issue of research hospital. When did that come up, or?
That came up. I can't give you the exact date, but that's in the federal government in those days was providing money to medical schools for construction of facilities. Life Science One had been built with partially federal money. In addition, the university had received a federal construction grant for construction of a hospital. The legislature did not and would not appropriate money for it. So the grant was dissipated. It went the way of all flesh. The plans were for a Life Science II building. And at the same time, the university began construction or remodeling of East Fee Hall for the College of Osteopathic Medicine for offices. Andy Hunt and I sat down and had a discussion, and I think there was agreement that while undoubtedly we needed a Life Science II building, medical students had to have patients upon which to learn, and medical school faculty had to have patients to take care of to keep their skills in. And so we agreed that instead of Life Science II, we would go to the legislature and ask for funding for a teaching clinic. The agreement was made that along with the construction of the teaching clinic would be the tower in which there would be offices, and we agreed that East Fee Hall would be primarily for the College of Osteopathic Medicine, and the new tower would be primarily for the College of Human Medicine. The teaching clinic would be shared by both colleges. Jerry Favorman, in effect, we then hired as assistant dean for planning, basically wrote the building description for East Fee Hall. The legislature appropriated some of the money, but never in effect appropriated the remainder. There were some protests by students because East Fee Hall, East and West Fee Halls, were in effect the only places really where there were apartments, small apartments, the students. The initial remodeling of East Fee Hall, I thought, was done very, very well. The rest of the remodelings, I thought, were fairly atrocious. Mm-hmm. Occurred later on, university money. Money was not appropriated for the rest of the remodeling for a number. There was supposed to be a bridge on the third floor between East and West Fee Halls. The Speaker of the House, who was an Eastern Michigan proponent, this is what they say, basically, when Eastern Michigan finished its dormitory remodeling, money never came. Whether the university pushed or didn't push, I don't know. The remodeling was never completed. In fact, I refused to allow our people to move into some of the spaces that hadn't been remodeled. Mm-hmm. They were atrocious, and everyone agreed they were atrocious, but whether the university had no money or whether felt that they had to use it for something else. Then when Cecil Mackey and Ken Thompson came aboard, I think Ken got some money and did some more remodeling, which was adequate. Not as good as the first, but adequate. In addition, we had relatively little control over who came or went into Fee Hall. It's basically been used as a dumping ground by the university for units that they had no place else to put them. In addition, from the original plan, there were some changes made so that units moved in here that never should have. Some doing research that probably shouldn't have been carried out in a building such as this, and so on.
What about the question of the dissolution of the nursing school?
Well,
was it just a cost-cutting attempt, or?
In my opinion, Cecil Mackey, up until that time, was probably the smartest president we had had. In that he was, not that he was smarter than Cliff Wharton, but he was certainly more experienced. Because with all due respect to Cliff, who was a delightful and intelligent man, Cliff had had no experience. Cecil probably was correct from a budget viewpoint as to what units should have been dissolved and what units shouldn't. I think the whole thing was handled very badly politically, from a political viewpoint. First of all, and I went over and had a private talk with Cecil, which he may or may not remember, although many of us were blamed by nursing for wanting to see the school dissolved, I went over and tried to convince them not to take on that fight. There was a nursing shortage. There was no way you were going to win that kind of a battle. One of the difficulties with Michigan State, and I think part of its difficulty still, is that it still doesn't know what it wants to be when it grows up. What we do is we add units and underfund them. We're willing to tolerate mediocrity, and we can point out places. No policy decision was made vis-a-vis nursing, in that if you're going to keep nursing, then you've got to put in funding to make it as good as anything around. No question about that. Policy decisions, what do you want out of nursing? University of Michigan made a decision that nursing, they would focus on the graduate component in nursing. That's fine. I'm not saying what nursing should focus on, but I think the University of Nursing in those days should have made a decision. Isabel Payne, to her credit, fought like a Trojan to...
Among the Spartans.
fought like a Trojan to get... keep nursing, and she won that battle. I thought it was a turbulent time in this university and very unnecessary. We had such things as public hearings in the Kellogg Center, absolutely devastating, where the members of the board and the president would sit up there and be pilloried by the audience. People such as PhD, biophysicist who was in the College of Human Medicine, getting up and making rash statements about family practice and so on and so on and so on. I thought public relations-wise it was bad. I thought it tore this university apart. It was a noble attempt to do the best